Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:36 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is August 25th. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And today I would just like to start off with a graphic where we can see very clearly that the last time we had a period of synchronized global economic expansion was back in 2007. And since then, it's been either one economy or the other has been contracting. And this is the first time, 2017 is the first time in a decade almost, then that we've actually had a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and that there's accelerating growth in the majority of countries. There's a smaller number of countries have got slowing growth, but it's all positive. And that is part of the reason that the central banks are starting to talk about what to do about all the money that they have poured into the system. And this is an important chart. It's something that I created when I was writing Crowd Money, and unfortunately I can't put it into the chart library because it's got so much calculation in it, and it's not a ticker that is publicly available within the Bloomberg. But what it characterizes is all of the central bank balance sheets redenominated into dollars at $19.49 trillion right now. That's for the US, the ECB, the UK, the Bank of China, and the Bank of Japan. And I don't know about you, but I think that's a lot of money. What we can also draw a conclusion from here is that we have had a very positive environment in stock markets over the first half of this year. By and large, they have paused over the last few months, but there has been a significant uptick in the quantity of money that is pouring into the system. It's at $19.5 trillion. There is nothing on that chart says it's not going to get to $20 trillion. And when we look at what have Mario Draghi and Janet Yellen been saying today in Jackson Hole, well, they've talked about regulation. And this is something that we see. If we look at, take a very broad perspective, and we look at the way that there is something that we talk about on the first day of the chart seminar, and it is whether a breakout from a range changes the fundamentals, or does it change the perception of the fundamentals? And it's a big question, because it doesn't change the fundamentals on a short-term basis, but the longer that a breakout persists for, the greater a bull market becomes, the more it has the potential to change the fundamentals of the market. And that happens both on the upside and the downside. So what have we had in the last decade? It's been a very clear response to the previous bull market in regulation, I guess in the easing of regulations. In the last decade, what we've had is the tightening of regulations. That tightening of regulation has occurred against a background where we have had incredible monetary largesse. It's disingenuous for central bankers to talk about the fact that the tightening of regulation has not restricted access to liquidity or to credit when they are pouring torrents of cash into the global economy. We could really only rationally or even academically reach that kind of conclusion against a background of neutral monetary policy, and we are still a long way from neutral monetary policy. And if this chart is any indication, what we are in fact seeing is an acceleration in monetary largesse, despite the fact that the Federal Reserve has largely stopped adding new money to the system. This is the chart of the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. It has been pretty much inert for much of the last 3 years. They are only beginning to talk about how they can even try to reduce the size of the balance sheet. It's an enormous question that they have in front of them, and it isn't something that's going to get answered in any time soon. When we think about what we have in terms of the ECB, then they have doubled the size of their balance sheet in the last 3 years. And €2.5 trillion euro pumped into the system is not an inconsiderable sum. So when we look at, for example, the Euro Stoxx index, we've had a significant rally over the last few years. But it without the monetary largesse that we've had from the ECB, could that have occurred? Would it in fact be more like, for example, back in the early part of 2014, the index was right around 300. It's currently around 373. But of course, this is an index for the entire Eurozone. What we have seen is that there is massive disparities in both economic performance and the level of confidence that investors have in various parts of the Eurozone. But without that monetary largesse that has been added into the market over the last 3 years, there's a good chance that this index would be closer to 200 than it is to 375. When we look at the DAX index, for example, then we're given a very clear picture of where the benefit has been accrued. That back at the in the beginning of this monetary largesse period, at the beginning of 2014, the index was at 8,000, and today it's at 12,000. So a 50% advance in 3 years, and not at least funded by the quantity of money that has been poured into the system. And of course, part of the reason for that is because Germany has gone through is one of the most outward looking of the European economies. It's a massive exporter, not least to the rest of the EU, but also it doesn't have the same need for internal regulatory reform or economic reform that is evident in just about most of the other Eurozone countries. For example, the CAC index gives us a very different story. The CAC is jammed full of exporting and major exporters, but it looks nothing like the DAX index. And part of the reason for that is because we have a very different regulatory environment in France. One of the big questions that overhangs the Eurozone, one of the reasons that it has underperformed, is because there are competing domestic and Eurozone-wide ambitions. And generally speaking, what has been a very clear trend among politicians in just about all Eurozone countries has been to take credit for the successes that have come from the Eurozone and blame domestic failures on the Eurozone. So the Eurozone can't win. And that is acting as a headwind to reform. For France, quite how Macron is going to tackle its militant unions is very much an open question. And certainly there hasn't been much appetite for that, not least to simply clear blockages in the transportation network by just bringing in the army is probably the only way to get it done. And that is something that nobody has appetite for in France, or at least not recently. But this is the it's a clear example of the paradox that is facing the Eurozone, because what the political ambition is for tighter union. But of course, what tighter union means is that there is going to have to be some kind of federal taxation system and a formal network of transfers. And that is going to be a very hard sell, not least for countries like Germany. So that is a continuing threat to the Eurozone. And it's something that the ECB is very aware of. So they're going to be very cautious about withdrawing liquidity from the system. That's, I think, why they're concentrating on talking about regulatory, the or I guess what they're really talking about is MiFID II, and what that is going to represent for the European banking sector. Europe looks on what the mistakes were made as to and what they're looking at, and it's very clearly that they are fighting the last war, was that there was very little regulation, and that allowed masses of money to flow around the Eurozone and to get misallocated, and that there was no clear responsibility for who was going to pay back that money, and the result was that it was all going to get pushed onto the consumer. But MiFID II is a direct response to that. If I go back to my original point, when we look at what we have right now, is that we have had a massive tightening of regulation. And against that background, we have had an incredible increase in the supply of money. So eventually, that regulation is going to represent a headwind to growth. And when we think about the way that these things work, is that over long periods of time, over decades, you go through periods where you have loose regulation and then you have easy regulation. You have periods of time where regulation tightens over a number of years and then eases over a number of years. And we're beginning to see the turn in the US. That was where the epicenter of the last crisis was. That's where we had thousands of pages of legislation and Dodd-Frank representing this massive wall of legislation, which is almost impossible to understand. And now they're already employing algorithms and artificial intelligence to try and make sense of that piece of regulation. Well, now we're starting to come out the other side of that, where people are starting to ask legitimate questions about whether it can be done better, and whether it is quite necessary to have this vast amount of regulation. We're just not there yet in Europe, because Europe's big crisis happened a number of years after the credit crisis. The sovereign wealth crisis, the sovereign debt crisis, was a much more of a 2010 event rather than a 2007 event. So it could be a number of years before we get to a point where, and not least because MiFID II is only coming into enforcement in January, whereas Dodd-Frank has already been in existence for a number of years already. So Europe is still lagging, not only on a regulatory front, it's lagging on a stock market front, it's lagging on the monetary policy front. It is in just about every fashion, the Eurozone is a lagging indicator. It's not a lead indicator for what we can expect. In fact, when we think about the what we've had in terms of the impact that massive monetary accommodation has had on stock markets, then we don't have to look further than the S&P 500. And that is why Europe is potentially a recovery candidate. It obviously has these challenges I've already spoken of, but the fact is that the ECB is going to be very cautious, because they have already experimented with withdrawing liquidity, and they took €1 trillion out of circulation, and then they had to put back in €2.5 trillion. That, in other words, it was a mistake to take that money out of circulation. Everyone is aware of that, and that would suggest that any talk about reducing the size of balance sheets is going to be incredibly tentative. And there is nobody believes that we are going back to the levels of central bank balance sheets that existed before the financial crisis, that they are feeling their way, and that literally we could have this quantity of money sloshing around for the lengthy medium term. As long as the aggregate quantity of money flowing into the global economy is improving, then we're likely to be in a bullish environment, because that monetary accommodation is both mobile and global. And as a measure of that, there was this chart I also found, and It was the global equity flows, and that if I can move that up, then we can see that at the beginning of the chart here, it is at early 2016, and from the region of the presidential election, the quantity of money that has flowed into global equity funds is quite astounding. It's in the region of $150 billion. When we look at what has perhaps been the best performing stock market index on Wall Street, then it's the Nasdaq. And it went from 1,000 in 2009 to almost 6,000 today. And that is a jolly impressive advance. But it is right in the region of 6,000. It is somewhat overextended relative to the trend mean, and we are getting a pause in the region of this big psychological level. But again, considering that the quantity of money that central banks are adding into the system, then as long as that remains the case, it's hard to argue with the fact that there is potential for additional upside. The fact that the dollar is so weak would suggest that that is also helping to boost the value of major exporting companies, and there are a significant number of them in the US, simply by virtue of the fact that the dollar is going down. And of course, by the same token, it has had an impact on Eurozone stocks as well, because the euro has been so strong. But when we look at the dollar index, it was in additional weaker territory again in here today and moved to a new reaction low. This is right at the lower side of the range. It is badly in need of a clear upward dynamic to confirm support in this area, and so far there has been precious little in the way of upward dynamics. And today's move represents a breakdown from this range, which was relatively similar size to the one we saw in June, which was relatively similar size to the one we saw in May. So it was an equal size range in the context of a downtrend that has been in evidence since really the first week of the year. As long as the dollar is trending lower, that's likely to be a tailwind for nominal stock prices in the US. It's probably less of a factor for the Russell because these are smaller cap shares, but even there this week we saw some evidence of it finding support in the region of the trend mean and bouncing from the lower side of the range it's been in for just about all of this year. The transportation index, which had also been underperforming, has also at least steadied in the region of the trend mean and the lower side of its range for this year, whereas the Dow Jones has been really quite steady. It's just holding here in the region of this 22,000 level. And when we look at this trend over the almost decade from the very beginning of 2009, the biggest reactions that we've seen were in 2011 and in 2015. And what did they coincide with? Well, 2011 was the removal of quantitative easing, was the end of QE2, and 2015 through to the end at the beginning of 2016 was at the end of QE3. Since the end of QE3, the size of the Fed's balance sheet has not moved. And what we are beginning to see is what is in fact regulatory arbitrage. People are looking at the current administration, which is dominated by the Republican Party in the US, and concluding that a Republican-dominated Congress and Senate is going to push through a tax cut. In fact, that there is almost a cause and effect relationship in terms of how the investing community views that kind of outcome. So that is part of the reason why investors have been willing to pour so much money into stock markets. It's because they believe that there's going to be a tax cut. They believe that there's going to be some form of change to corporate taxation and potentially even a tax holiday or some form of arrangement that will allow these very large companies to bring some of that money earned overseas home. So That is part of the reason that we're starting to see these advances. What I find quite interesting is that over the last few months, what we have had is a major uptick in the amount of anxiety that is being expressed by investors. And part of the reason for that is not only because the VIX index has been a bit stronger over the last few weeks, but because it has been so low for so long, and the correlation that we have with bond market volatility being so low as well. This is the Merrill Lynch option volatility estimate, and it's at well, it was at historic lows, and it's still close to the lows posted back in early 2013. Everyone knows what happens when you get very low volatility, that eventually you will get higher volatility. But generally speaking, the best way to use volatility measures is after the spike. It's usually a buying opportunity. That contracting volatility doesn't necessarily have the same effect. And what we can say with regard to any volatility measure is that spikes higher are generally not sustained, whereas declines can last for longer than a lot of people anticipate. People are looking on volatility and saying, well, golly, it's very cheap, so we have to own it. But of course, what that is ignoring is the time value of money. And that's part of the reason why those short ETFs for volatility have been so profitable, is because they are arbitraging that time value of money, that they are betting that the volatility will stay low for long enough for the contract to expire. And that is where they're making their money. Now, when we start to look around the world, and we are in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and then when we think about the kinds of markets that benefit from global economic expansion, well, Taiwan is trading above 10,000 for the first time since 1990. The Korean market, where the prime minister fell, and today the heir to the Samsung empire was convicted to 5 years for bribery. But none, and not least, when we talk about open the newspaper, there is inevitably going to be some kind of story about North Korea. And nonetheless, the Korean market is trading at new all-time highs, having completed a 5-year range in just the last few months. When we look at, for example, Indonesia, which is a high population country, which is really one of the markets that is likely to benefit most from improving standards of governance, and Widodo has survived and is a force for improving governance in the country. The rupiah has been really quite firm. It's been, in fact, it's been largely inert for the last few months, and the index is trading at new all-time highs. The Indian market, where we have this evidence of improving governance, and the Nifty is pausing in the region of the 10,000 level. But the most important thing that's happened is that the rupee is strengthening up, that inflation is coming down. And for a country like India, inflation coming down is a massive change. So then those are the high population countries. These are the either the ones that are technologically advanced and are benefiting from that, or these are the kinds of company of countries that benefit from global economic expansion from the consumer front. But on the commodity front, the South African index has completed a multi-year range and is breaking on the upside. And this is against a background today where the rand was quite firm. When we look at the Brazilian market, the real has been pretty firm as well, and the Bovespa is trading through 70,000 for the first time since 2010. So again, these are significant moves in large emerging markets. These are the kinds of markets that are leveraged to global growth. So One has to ask what's going on with Australia. And part of the reason that the index has not been doing better, that it has been so range-bound, is it's not because the resources sector isn't doing better, because the resources sector is doing better. But it's because the resources sector went down so much between 2011 and early 2016 that it now represents a much smaller weighting in the overall index. On the other hand, the financials represent a much larger weighting. Almost, it's not quite, but it's almost 50% of the index. And the financials index has been pretty rangy. There is also, of course, the political uncertainty that has arisen over the last few days with is it the Vice Prime Minister, who is a dual Australian and New Zealand citizen, and this old law that you cannot be a dual citizen if you want to hold a political position. So there is the potential that we're going to have either a cabinet reshuffle or there's going to be an election, considering it's a minority government. And that represents an uncertainty. And of course, because Australia and indeed Canada, and of course Canada is much more heavily influenced by what happens with oil prices, then the Canadian market has been ranging around the 6,000 level since 2014. And the let me see if I can remember the Canadian banks index, or the financials index. Both the Canadian and the Australian banks sidestepped the financial crisis, and so far they have been pretty rangy. They are still, despite the fact that real estate prices in both Canada and Australia are certainly not cheap, they are likely to benefit from commodity price inflation. If we get a continued economic growth and a further rebound in commodity prices, that is likely to be positive for both Canada and Australia. And we can look at a number of different commodity indices. So, for example, it is the industrial metals have been doing best. The LME Metals Index has broken up out of its range for the year so far, and it is running again on the upside. It is being led higher by copper, which cruised through $3 in here today, and that represents a pretty emphatic move up through a psychological level. But of course, it's not just that we're seeing copper doing better. The zinc market, and it's a long ticker, so I apologize for my typos, is also doing better here and has broken through the 3,000 level in the last couple of weeks. And when we look at, for example, nickel, which has been a serial laggard within the sector, then it is also beginning to show signs of life in here and is firming from the 10,000 level. And this is really quite depressed relative to the other industrial metals. It's coming off of lows that we haven't seen really since 2008. When we look at, for example, the Continuous Commodity Index, which is an unweighted index of a significant basket of commodities, then we don't have the same story. And part of the reason for that is because the relative weakness in the agricultural sector. When we look at a number of the grains and beans, I think it's an underestimate or an understatement to say that they're not rallying. They've been subject to really quite acute volatility, and they are still at pretty depressed levels. That isn't to say that they're not capable of rallying, and certainly sugar is beginning to get a little bit of traction because of Hurricane Harvey, but it's got a long way to go. And the geographical spread for where these commodities are concentrated is also an indication that there was plenty of additional supply brought online, and that we have had generally benign growing environments, so prices are lower. And of course, a very large question is about what's going to happen with the oil price. oil has been pretty rangy, and when we look at the chart, particularly over the last 2 years, it's been very volatile. Now, of course, this is an asset that is historically volatile, and it is being buffeted by a whole slew of competing arguments. And I think there are three big arguments. One is the evolution of unconventional oil and gas. We've recognized that as a game changer for years, and that is well priced into the market at this stage. It isn't as influential an aspect for the market any longer, particularly relative to how important it was when it was just getting started. It has already contributed to the low prices that we have. The higher prices go, the more drilling wells are going to be put to work, and the more profitable the operations are going to be. But I think that's really already in the price. I think the two big questions that are out there on the medium term are: one is the pace of technological innovation, the rate at which it's not just that solar technology is improving at a rapid rate. It's not that wind technology is improving at a rapid rate, but rather that we are getting the critical capacity in terms of battery production is coming online. And what that is contributing to is both batteries that are designed for stationary power storage and for transportation. And for the oil market, is the transportation sector is a key variable. I think the diesel scandal has been a gift for companies like Tesla, and eventually we are going to have more electric vehicles on the road. It is going to take time to retool. It's going to take time to get them up to a position where they are truly competitive. And it is also going to take time to retool people's homes for charging, because the amperage that they need is often considerably more than is actually in people's houses. So it does require a few $100 installation charge before one can charge at their own home. But the big question is the power to weight ratio and the recharging times. There are patents being lodged all the time, and Toyota is certainly at the forefront of lodging these patents for solid state batteries, which have faster charging times and have better power to weight ratios. They originally said that they would have these batteries on the market by 2020, and they've lodged additional patents, but they've pushed back their estimate to 2022. Now, if we do get batteries within the next 5 years that have got much better range, much better charging times, and much better costs, then that is going to represent an existential threat to the internal combustion engine. And not least because governments, when they see that there are options available for alternatives, they will legislate to begin to ban the types of cars that have got emissions coming out the tailpipe from cities. And we're already beginning to see the beginnings of that. And that represents a significant threat to oil prices. It means that as new sources of demand will need to evolve. There is ample potential for new sources of demand to evolve when the global population is going to increase by perhaps another 2 billion over the next 30 years. And the rapid pace of economic development and in major population countries, and particularly in Asia and increasingly in Africa, is going to create additional demand for gasoline. But that is a long-term demand driver, and the question is whether that is going to be enough to stimulate prices above $60. A great deal of additional supply becomes economic at $60. The other big question for the oil price is the Saudi Arabia IPO. They want a lot of money. They're looking for a $100 billion IPO, and that they anticipate that representing about 5% of the index of the value of the company. Excuse me, and they do then want to go off and borrow against the rest of it. So they want to generate a significant amount of money, but that 2 billion, excuse me, that $100 billion valuation is probably based on prices closer to $100, and the big question is whether Saudi Arabia is going to attempt to muscle the market higher for the medium term. Are they going to try and reassert their influence on the market, albeit on the, in the short term, so that they can demonstrate to the world that they're still the dominant player in the market? It's a big question. It's something that a lot of people are speculating on, and prices are stabilizing above the trend mean and around the progression of lower rally highs. I still believe that $60 represents a really quite significant psychological Rubicon for oil prices, but there is no denying that prices are reasonably firm around this $50 area, and there is the potential for a short-ish term rally or a medium-term period of strength simply because of market manipulation. By the time that washes out, then we could have prices coming down rapidly, and not least because if Saudi Arabia were to go on that kind of route, it would have a deleterious effect on their public finances. What we can definitely say is that oil prices have become less volatile over the last month, and as long as they're holding the move above $50, then there is the potential for additional upside in here. And gasoline prices are getting quite interesting. They were quite volatile in here today, and as people are arbitraging the risk from Hurricane Harvey, and the price is currently around 167 and a half, and the potential is that there is more damage than people are anticipating, and we get higher prices. It's a big question, and a move above 180 would begin to suggest that more damage than people are anticipating has in fact occurred. When we take a long-term perspective, then, and in terms of the flow of money and where we are in terms of the cycle, we are in a period of synchronized global economic expansion, and it's been a long time since we've had one of those. In the 9 years that since we've had a period of synchronized global economic expansion, we've had massive monetary largesse. Central bankers are going to do whatever they can to protect their legacy, and that means that the pace of interest rate rises is going to be very benign. It's going to be moderate. They're not going to rush. The only thing that they would rush for is if we get evidence of inflation picking up. But of course, the way that they measure economic growth is fits their own models, and whether it is even possible to for GDP to capture the kind of growth that is occurring, and to even begin to take account of the deflationary impact of technological innovation is a massive question that central bankers don't appear willing to answer at all. We saw ample evidence of that from their statements in Jackson Hole today, and at the same time, they don't seem prepared to answer other big questions either. They don't know what the impact of all this monetary largesse is going to have. So they're going to be very cautious, and that would suggest that this benign environment where we have global economic expansion and a moderate pace of interest rates rising, that will generally mean that the commodity complex should be doing better. and it should be among the better performing sectors as we move into a period where interest rates will become more of a headwind. Now, that also means that commodities will not be the leading sector to peak. That will be something else. And what it would suggest is that it's probably worth keeping an eye on the consumer staples sector. And the consumer staples sector was among the best performing and most consistent advances since 2009. It is right now in the region of the trend mean. And if we were to see a significant deterioration, and by that I mean that it breaks below the trend mean and then encounters resistance in the region of the trend mean, in other words, completes a top, well, then we might have some clue as to when we're going to have the next problem evolving. But we're still a long way from that. And we're also a long way from monetary policy representing a headwind. The yield curve is contracting, but it is certainly not below zero. And when we get an inverted yield curve, it generally means that we have a lead indicator of over a year. So that would suggest that we're years away from the next recession, and that the rebound in commodities is likely to be an impressive one, that the kinds of things that we look for as lead indicators for big problems are not yet flashing red, and we're seeing an increasing number of global markets breaking on the upside, and generally consistent trends in the majority of the rest of the global stock market, that there are massive themes that are evolving in terms of the rise of the global consumer, the revolutions that we're getting in both energy and the massive pace of technological innovation, the rapid pace not only of innovation but the extent to which it is going global, that when technology is developed now, that it becomes a global market, and that is something that is helping to lift billions of people out of poverty and into the middle classes. It also represents a headwind in terms of the consumer, and these are challenges that are being seen on the political front. What we can see is that protectionism is a potential threat out there on the horizon. It's something that Mario Draghi was talking about today as well. But there is no denying that I think this is the commoditization of labor has contributed to rising living standards in a number of low-cost countries and generally stagnant or lower living standards in high-cost countries. And it isn't a coincidence that the biggest problems with debt are in those higher cost countries, that the lower living standards have been compensated by increasing debt loads. This is a big evolving question. It's a big problem. It's going to become a bigger problem, not least because there is a wave of people that are going to be retiring, and there is going to be a significant number of younger people going to have to take on the burden of higher taxation. And that is contributing to the rise not only of populism. I really don't think that populism is the best term for it, but rather that it's reactionism. It's reactionism to the status quo. Then those, not only protectionism, but it's also antitrust, represent problems. These are potential issues that stand out there on the horizon as potential problems, but they are unlikely to represent short to medium term problems. And I think that that is why we're still in a benign bullish environment. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.